guy emailed me that they don't, the page results will be on the website shortly. Breaking our heart how much Winona needed to find out those results.
You said that?
She said that, yeah.
Hi, Stag's on.
This is Rick.
Hey, Rick.
Barbara. Hello?
Hi.
Hi.
Yeah, I didn't catch who that was.
This is Deborah Rich.
Hey, Deborah, how you doing?
Good, how are you?
Good. Do I have Todd yet or not?
Yes, sir.
Ah, great. That's
essential.
We've got the essential participant. For those of you who don't know Todd, he's been the team vet for the USA East several times, and he keeps us in stitches between Todd and Ann. And you're one of the vets to the World Championship this year, right?
Yeah, Jim. Yeah, Jim, Brian, and I.
Okay, and Todd is also professor at Oklahoma State. Did I get that one right?
Yes, sir. As long as you don't say OU.
Okay, I won't. And I won't tell too many stories about you, Todd, tonight.
Not the carrot story, please.
Not the carrot story.
So what, like the other participants, just so I kind of got an idea as far as who we're talking to, as far as level of questions and answers and stuff. I got from Cheryl that the main topic was transport stress. Is that right?
Yeah.
Kind of a free-for-all.
Yeah, I mean, right now I think we've got a couple on. People probably be joining, but Deborah and Rick went on, you know, Todd, he's done research on ulcers, among many other things, plus as I said, he's a top endurance vet who's been the vet to USA's team and the world team and all. So what are your hottest topics, sort of given the general area of transport stress and ulcers, et cetera?
I think not just transport stress, but the effect of electrolytes on gastric. I mean, I've never had my mare scoped, so I don't know whether she has a gastric ulcer or a colon ulcer. I just read Dr. Ridgway's article last night on gastric and colon ulcers, and I guess just any information on the how the electrolytes, I guess, interplay with that would be interesting to me, especially when you got a horse that doesn't necessarily eat at every hold.
Yeah, and honestly, sorry, I'm catching a cold, so if I sound like I'm going through puberty, it's not true. I did that a while ago. but my voice is kind of quavering. I apologize. So your question really is the effect then a horse, it sounds like, that you compete typically doesn't eat well in the holds?
Well, I suspect, you know, sometimes she goes through periods where I can't get her to collect well, and Dr. Ridgway just saw her down at the Newman's and definitely picked up things on her ulcer points. And she typically at the first hold will not eat very much unless there's grass, but she'll refuse the alfalfa, she refuses beet mash, she refuses grain. And sometimes she doesn't drink until after 20 miles, and so she's probably compounding the problem. But then if it's a hot, humid day, we want to give her some electrolytes.
Yeah, and I guess, honestly, that question that you pose is one of my most burning questions that I would love to address with the right kind of research study. But to me, and there are probably a number of other experienced riders on the call that can throw in their input, but to me it's very typical for horses not to drink in the first 20 miles. You know, how many of them eat, I think, probably depends on a lot of factors. One of them is, you know, what they're offered, but I think the other one that's very important in our hands is, you know, it's been my experience when you shove, you know, nasty electrolytes down their throat, you know, in their mouth, even if you try to wash them out, many times and I'm just don't have any scientific data to back it up, but my suspicion is that it does throw them off feed. You know, some horses do not like it at all, and I think, you know, is it the oral stimulation, you know, what it tastes like? Is it some pain response in their stomach if they do have ulcers, or is it just, you know, I don't think I'd want to eat, I like salt and pepper on my tomatoes, but I don't take 3 tablespoons of salt before I eat my tomato.
Right, well, we try not to electrolyte them until the hold is almost over for that reason, but...
Yeah, I still think it plays a role, and the only way I know to get around it is to prove it in a research study with some new products that we have, and I'm in the midst of trying to design that, but I don't have anybody to pay for it yet. To me, and that's a big thing that I think the French are doing, and I've talked to one of their veterinarians to several of their veterinarians and some other veterinarians that do similar things in international competition, and the French are doing quite well, and part of it certainly is their training and their horses and all that multifactorial stuff, but they say they don't electrolyte during competition, and they do, I've learned recently that most of their electrolytes are given prior to, and I've heard one of their veterinarians speak, talking about direct conversations with their trainers and riders, that they started that whole scenario of not electrolyting during competition because they felt like it was throwing their horses off feed. And since then, they have, you know, by doing it prior to starting competition, they feel like their horses are eating better and drinking better. And to me, as a veterinarian on either side of the line, you know, as somebody in the, you know, the pits trying to keep the horse going versus a veterinarian on the line looking at sick horses, you know, when they don't drink that and eat, you know, primarily when they quit eating, that's a major sign that something's wrong. And if we're doing something, you know, giving them electrolytes that could potentially upset their stomach, you know, or appetite in any way, then that's deleterious in my opinion. But that's just an opinion. It has to be proven by science, you know, before you go advocating it. I'm not meaning to say that electrolytes don't need to be used. I just think maybe we could give them more, you know, with more knowledge behind it when we give them and how we give them. Try to keep the horses from going off their feed.
Tond, there was speculation when the French said they aren't given electrolytes that they were no longer giving electrolyte doses, but they were actually giving isotonic electrolyte solution in the water. That is, you know, their 5-gallon bucket of water the horses would come in and drink had electrolytes dissolved in it.
Yeah, and there are some good studies on that that show horses that are given that, you know, that are trained to drink that solution will regain their weight quicker than horses that are just fed water, and compared to horses that are just given water and a dose of electrolytes by Pace, if I'm remembering that right. But I suspected the same thing as that you just said, but I, you know, recently saw one of the French veterinarians that works with a team in San Antonio and talked to her pretty candidly, and she said, no, they're electrolyting. They're just doing it before competition.
But then do they double dose them? Are they, like, electrolyte loading them?
They're loading them, yeah.
But, like, you're still going to affect the stomach lining then, aren't you?
Well, that's what I'm saying. I don't know that we know that, in my mind, the benefit of not how do I word this? I'm not advocating that we stop using electrolytes at all, period. We need them. The horse needs them. They lose tremendous quantities in their sweat when they work, but I think we could give them smarter. And is that by preloading them like we just described? Is that by giving them in water in an isotonic solution like you would put in your eye for contact solution? It's an isotonic salt solution, so it's not damaging the tissues. That's what all of our tissues are bathed in. So there's a number of ways you could approach it. And some of them have been scientifically approached and some of them haven't. So you know, without doing the right study, you can't really say what benefit the French are getting from that. The anecdotal experience benefit that they're describing from talking to people that work with the team is that those horses eat better in the holds, drink better in the holds, you know, and you can imagine how that really strong salt solution could affect your appetite for sure, but it's, to my knowledge, not yet proven scientifically.
Todd, this is Cheryl. Just as a, trying to think that one through, I feel like I'm missing a real key insight on the preloading. Because if I preload, and it, maybe I'm thinking in terms of large quantities and they're only doing moderate quantities or something like this, I would anticipate the horse would back off from its food before competition. And to my way of thinking, that raises a major red flag right there, too.
Yeah, and I don't know how they're doing it. I agree, if you know, anything we do that throws them off their feed or water, and here we're talking about electrolytes, can be an important negative factor. You know,
not even losing them at that stage.
Well, sure. You know, but most, I don't know what y'all do nowadays, but a lot of competitors will pre-dose the night before or at least the morning before they start. I don't know what your experience has been, if you wait for the first, you know, the first or second vet check or what, but, you know, I just look at, well, and again, it's got to be proven. Somebody needs to pay for the study to, you know, to get the data to support it. But I, you know, I can only use my scientific knowledge and try to predict what's occurring in those horses, if indeed that's what they're doing. I'm assuming they're loading them with a pretty concentrated solution or concentrated paste. And, you know, one time may have a lot less effect on a horse's appetite, you know, than multiple times at a smaller dose. We don't know. You know what I'm saying?
Well, also, you know, if you're doing it the day before, you've got a fairly lengthy period of time to...
Sure.
...for the horse to get over the...
Cover.
...get over it. But, because I know what we've been doing... is we'll actually give them a couple of doses, sort of half of our race day dose, I guess, the day before.
Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people do that.
And then we've been dosing about once an hour, day of competition, just before they start, and then once an hour.
Sure.
But we've now gone to using carrot. Baby carrot food as the, you know, to mix with it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you look at our ulcer study, the severity of gastric ulcers that, you know, grade-wise that we saw after the once-an-hour dosing scheme, and that's what I based it on, was kind of Southeast competitors in the high heat and humidity that dose it every hour. So we did that for 8 hours, 8 doses, allowed those horses to drink water if they so chose, and allowed them to eat for about 15 minutes at one period during that hour throughout those eight doses. You know, the severity of ulcers, you know, as a clinician, they weren't shocking. And the hard thing about ulcers is, depending on the group of horses that you look at with an endoscope, you know, if they're show horses, 60, 70, 80% of them might have ulceration. If they're race horses, 80, 90% of them in training might have ulcers. But, you know, 90% of those horses don't necessarily show clinical signs. So you can have a lot of horses out there with varying grades of ulcers that live with them and, you know, don't cause them a problem. So I have to interpret the data that we got, you know, in light of all my clinical knowledge of how many horses I see with ulcers and how hard it is to know really convincingly if that ulcer in that individual horse truly is causing that individual a problem. So in my, you know, simple way of thinking, in my practical mind, I think that potentially us throwing horses off feed by dosing them very frequently can play a role. And I think it's individual variation. Some horses deal with it and don't seem to have a problem with it. But I think there are some horses out there that probably are more likely to go off their feed when they're dosed very frequently. But again, that's just a total non-scientifically aborted, you know, supported opinion.
Ag and Cheryl, are you giving a full dose every hour?
Well, it depends on how you define a dose. Yeah, we were given out, you know, 1 to 2 ounces is a typical dose when people say dose. Don't, when you say that, don't you think, Stag, isn't that what you think, 1 to 2 ounces when you dose your horse every hour?
Oh, what did we do, 2 ounces of performance wind, Cheryl?
It's a question of which electrolyte you're talking about. If you're doing something that looks like Enduramax, that's certainly the 1 to 2 ounces. If you're doing performance wind, you're doing closer to 6 ounces.
Yeah, and it really, that's a really important point that Cheryl just brought up. Every electrolyte, you know, nearly every electrolyte concentration is just a little bit different, and you have to be real careful about comparing A to B because you can't really do that unless you know what's in it.
Okay.
And performing wind has a lot of sugar in it, so, you know, a lot of different things that you have to get your electrolyte product out of your trailer or your tack box, wherever it's at, and look at it. And, you know, if you're going to change, compare what the next one is.
Yeah, I use something. It's called Ride Right from ABC, and I combine it with their ProBi, which, you know, as the probiotic factors and the herbal stuff, and we just mix that. I used to use applesauce or yogurt, but now I put that probiotic stuff in the syringe at the same time, but I don't know if it's helping.
Yeah, and nobody does, to be honest with you, know if it's helping, but the only thing I would caution you is to be careful with your, you mentioned an herbal product, so make sure there's nothing in there that will test.
Okay.
One of those other pitfalls.
Yep.
Yeah, let me just, I mean, to sort of emphasize what Todd said, one of the women who unfortunately had a positive drug test in ARC and not too long ago was feeding an herbal product that was designed to calm the horse, and the horse ended up testing positive for caffeine, which I think most of us agree is not a calming agent, although a lot of us may partake of that drug liberally. And what happened, the poor woman was feeding an herbal product, I've forgotten the name of it, but anyway, it was basically supposed to be, it was extract from green tea, and supposedly the caffeine had been removed. And the maker of the herbal product thought they were getting, you know, decaffeinated green tea extract when the supplier to the maker of the herbal product was actually supplying them with caffeinated green tea extract. So this poor woman thought she was giving a product to calm her horse, and she was actually giving an illegal stimulant, and the purveyor of the product didn't even know what was in it. So one does have to be careful with the herbal products.
Okay.
Cheryl and Stag, this is Allison Bailey. I don't know if you knew I was on here.
No, we heard somebody else join, but hadn't had a chance to ask whom.
Sorry. I didn't have a chance to get a word in, so I just thought I'd let you know I was here. I also have a terrible cold, so.
I also electrolyte
every hour. And last year after Biltmore, came home and Kazar didn't want to eat grain at all when we got home. And I wanted to find out why. I threw him in the trailer, took him to NC State and had him scoped, and he was completely ulcer-free, so that was definitely not it. I've since decided the horse just, when he comes home, just wants to be left alone living in the field eating grass, so now that's what I do. So I'm out, leave him the heck alone, and then when he gets ready to come back up to the barn, he comes up and I feed him. So, but he also, on the trail, you know, will have, it seems more, not at the beginning of the ride, but, you know, it might be the third loop or something where he'll sort of back off a little when it's hotter and more humid on eating. But we'll eat grass, generally, always. But like I said, and then I had a second horse that our practice actually was buying endoscopy equipment this year, and they let people bring horses for free and get scoped, so I took a second horse, another one that I've had problems with eating at rides, and he also was ulcer-free, so I don't know what I'm doing right here, except leaving him alone and letting him eat grass, I guess. But both of those horses, when they're at rides, get electrolytes every hour, usually on the trail, if it's hot and humid anyway.
And I guess one thing we certainly don't know is, you know, do these horses that get electrolytes frequently like that, do they somewhat, it's a simple way to think about it, but do they become accustomed to it? You know, does their stomach adapt some way to the hypertonic solution? And the horses that we put in our study, again, the ulcer severity scores weren't alarming. They were just statistically significantly different. But those horses had not been given, you know, they came right off a pasture, and that's the first time they'd probably ever been dosed with that in their life. You know, and I do wonder if horses somewhat get used to it. But at the same time, I do feel like we need some studies that either identify ways to give electrolytes that we know they need in a different manner or in a different time frequency or something to try to prevent some of these horses that I do feel go off their feed because of it. And that'll take a pretty well-designed study, but I think somebody needs to look at that.
Dr. Ridgway's article mentioned these strips that I guess the people who make Succeed put out that you can use to test. Do you know anything about those?
Those are blood, occult blood strips.
Yeah, for fecal blood, and I guess it can help diagnose where the ulcers, because I guess some ulcers aren't picked up on the scope. They can be farther along the digestive tract.
Well, the scope only goes, you know, to the stomach and maybe into the duodenum if you're good enough to get in there and you have a long enough scope. Certainly the GI tract can bleed, you know, at any point from stem to stern. And that, you know, there has to be a certain amount of blood that comes through in the manure to pick up on those strips.
Okay.
Clinically, we very commonly will see horses that have ulcerations that don't necessarily bleed. So I don't know of any scientific studies in large numbers that have evaluated that product as far as how sensitive it is to the amount of blood that has to be present, and then two, to compare it to, say, endoscopy of the stomach, because they don't all bleed, that's for sure. But it is a tool you can use, and it's a tool you can use at home. You know, it doesn't take a lot of expertise to read the result.
They seem to have temporarily gone off the market.
Yeah, I tried to get them to send us some to do those kind of comparisons, and I wasn't able to get a hold of them. I don't know if they're. Did you try to get a hold of them recently?
And Stuart tried to get some for us, and Carrie Ridgway has been calling the firm, and they're not returning phone calls and all, so it's nobody's quite sure what's going on there.
Okay.
Your view would be if they come back on the market there, if you get a positive test, it could be an indication. Well, let me ask it this way: if you got a negative test, does that say the horse doesn't have ulcers, or the horse could still have ulcers and you would get a negative test?
At least, again, I don't know how sensitive this. This particular test is, as far as its ability to detect minute quantities of blood. I would be real surprised if it had, if it approached, well, if you pass a scope in a horse and you see an ulcer, if you can see the entire stomach when you pass a scope, you know, it's a pretty useful test, right? Because if it's there, you're going to see it. Versus you have a small piece of paper or whatever the test material is, and you mix it with some manure. Well, if there's not a bleeding ulcer there, or if there hasn't been bleeding within a certain period of time that it takes that feed going from the stomach, you know, to the anus, then I can't imagine that it's as sensitive for gastric ulcers as a scope is. But I haven't seen the science. It's certainly a tool, but like you say, could your horse have ulcers and a negative test? I would expect that's possible, yeah.
Okay, so you're saying you can go both get false negatives and false positives.
I don't know the false positive rate, but I would assume that the false negative rate could be higher. But I, you know, without doing the science, I'm just pontificating.
Okay.
I would love to see their research study that they quote, but I haven't seen it in print. You know, sometimes drug companies will do research, and you have to contact their company to get the real data.
Okay. Todd, when you all did the study, how far ahead of time did you take the horses off feed?
That was a real problem with study design, because we know that taking horses off feed alone can cause gastric ulcers. So I tried to minimize the duration of time off feed to start with, because we know from research that, you know, that in itself, put them in a stall can actually cause ulcers. So we try to minimize it, and I'd have to pull that paper. From memory, I believe the first time I took them off for 20 hours and then scoped them, because I had to first tell if they didn't have ulcers, right? I had to record what they had going into the study. And then we put them back on pasture because we knew keeping up in a stall can cause ulceration. So we put them back on pasture for 24 hours. And then I think I started the study and, you know, went through the 8-hour protocol with both groups. And I think I held them off feed for a shorter period of time the second time, because I knew they weren't eating, you know, they weren't eating as much as they would be on pasture. I'd have to look at that data set to see how many hours it was. It's been about 4 years since we did it. I think this first time was 20 hours, if my memory is correct, and then the second time might have been either 12 or 18. I can't remember. It was a shorter period of time to try to minimize the effect of just being off feed.
Okay, and how
does that impact the quality of the endoscopy, would you judge, or is that too far in the distant past to?
What do you mean, Cheryl? Is that Cheryl?
Yeah.
As far as,
insofar as, okay, you've held them off the feed for 20 hours, and let's phrase it this way. I've had a colonoscopy, and okay, so you're off food or something or other for a certain amount of time, and then because they want everything to be absolutely clean, yada, yada, yada. Okay. And you get certain results because you've been off feed for XYZ period of time. Okay, so you take your period of time off food and you say, okay, what happens if you do two-thirds of that?
Yeah, and then without doing that study, I don't know that you can answer that at all. Okay. I thought and thought and thought and tried to redesign the study, you know, multiple times trying to figure out how to minimize the impact of feed restriction. You know, and if you, I think your initial question was, how did that impact your gastroscopy? Well, if I take a clinical horse that is not been held off feed,
mm-hmm,
and try to scope him, I cannot reliably evaluate his entire stomach. I can very frequently only be able to evaluate one half of his stomach at best.
The part that's above the
the border, you know, and the ulcers, excuse me, the ulcers are usually at the border between the glandular and the non-glandular. So,
mm-hmm,
you know, we knew we had to hold them off feed for a certain period of time. And I really, Dr. McAllister is here, one of the probably earlier kind of founding researchers in gastric ulcer studies, and he helped me design the study, and he, you know, we went back and forth about how to minimize it, and he was just concerned that, as I was too, that if we don't hold them off long enough, you know, we're not going to be able to see what we need to see to even get the numbers, you know, to get accurate representation of if they have them going in.
Yeah.
In the ideal study to me, to really look at, you know, what role electrolytes play, you can also look at it from a standpoint of, you know, can you go out in the field and do a field study? In the field study, the only one that I know done out of UC Davis, you know, indicated that they do have a pretty high prevalence of ulcers, and a lot of them bleed. If you look at the results of his study, there were quite a few of those horses that had bleeding glandular ulcers after the ride, and a little higher prevalence than we see with other gastric ulcer clinical studies. That wasn't something that he stressed really in his results, but it kind of caught my eye. You know, here he took horses after a competition and scoped them, and quite a few of them had bleeding ulcers. So, you know, until somebody looks at massive numbers of similar studies and tries to break them apart as to, you know, electrolyte product or did you not electrolyte during the ride, you know, those kind of studies might give us a little more information. But again, gastric ulcers, if you look at our populations of horses that we play with, you know, that we ride, that we compete, that we train, that we take to shows, that we take to endurance rides, you know, you can't find a consistent population that doesn't have ulcers, except for the horse that doesn't do anything, that's left at pasture and left alone. And even some of those horses, depending on what kind of diet they're on, even some of those have a pretty high prevalence of ulcers. It makes it really difficult for a clinician, for me to tell you, you bring me an individual horse, and I know he's a show horse, and that 70 or 80% of show horses have ulcers, and your horse is having these, you know, really indescript, problems. Well, he's not showing like he used to. He's not lame, but he just doesn't seem right to me. You know, and I scope him, and he's got ulcers. Well, I can't really tell you if the ulcers are causing him, you know, to swish his tail in the show ring. Do you know what I mean?
Yep.
When a high percentage of horses have the disease or the syndrome that we define by looking at the ulcers, and the clinical signs associated with them are fairly nondescript, it makes it real hard to have a lot of confidence in an individual animal that, yes, ma'am, your horse has ulcers and they are causing his problem. That's a real hard, hard statement to make with a lot of confidence.
You can make the statement that they have ulcers, but you can't necessarily make the leap of faith that this given issue that you're having with him is caused by ulcers.
Sure. So many times we treat them, and until they go away, and if the problem goes away, then we believe the ulcers caused the problem.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I think there's some scientific studies that, or some names for placebo effect. Yes, we did this.
Yeah. I mean, even the horses that were in the study that we did, the control group was given 60 mils of water every hour instead of the 60 mils of electrolyte paste with the syringe. They were dosed with water as a placebo effect, and those horses had worsened ulcer scores compared to entry.
Mm-hmm.
So there's definitely
how rapidly suppose we were to take a horse, keep him off feed for 20 hours, which I think that's long enough that the stomach should be clear, right?
So okay. Typically.
So we keep them off feed for 20 hours. If you're scoping them, is that time enough for an ulcer to develop? And if so, can you tell the difference between that ulcer and an ulcer that was already, you know, the horse came into the study with an ulcer? I mean, came into the period before the fasting with an ulcer.
Yeah, I think you can suspect, I wouldn't, you know, if it's a very deep ulcer versus very superficial.
Okay.
Yeah, you can surmise.
I think Deborah Terrell and I sort of monopolized the ulcer questions. Why don't we do one or two more on ulcers and then switch to more general reducing transportation stress and get Todd's thoughts. So I think we've got Allison and Rich on the line, right?
Yeah.
Do you all have further questions about ulcers? Allison seems to be doing it. What right? The key is grass. Now, if you can tell me how
that's
to pick
that's what
grass.
I think. Well, yeah. You know, the day I went up there to that to the free endoscopy, you know, when they were training those vets on the endoscopy equipment and we could go and have them check for free, I took with me another horse that belongs to one of my girlfriends that has been an endurance horse but hadn't been to a ride in a year because she tore a suspensory. That mare was chock full of ulcers and had done nothing for a year but sit in the pasture and eat grass and was pretty plump, to be honest with you. So, you know, you got to sit there and wonder. She was disgusted that my horse, you know.
You're not supposed to come back with a clean bill of health.
Right. And actually, they told me at the end of the day that I was the only one that brought a horse that, you know, didn't have any ulcers of any sort whatsoever. There were a lot of hunter jumpers there and, you know, your basic show horses and then us two endurance people. So, you know, who knows? You know, that's it. I mean, and when I took Kazar to NC State, the doctor that, you know, was doing the scoping and, you know, instructing all his students said, you know, well, gee, this is some of the healthiest stomach tissue we've seen in a long, long time, and said, whatever it is you're doing, you know, you need to keep doing it. So my suggestion to you is go back home and keep riding the horse. So I was like, okay. But you never know. I mean, you know, I got really excited about the whole isotonic thing after coming to the Apex Clinic in January down in Athens. And so just started experimenting at home with this idea of mixing actually performing when in buckets of water. And then certainly this summer when we've had temperatures in excess of 90 degrees here and, you know, on the South Carolina border, I started, if the horses were coming in to eat in their stalls, and I'd put a 1 5-gallon bucket of regular water and 1 5-gallon bucket that had some Performan Win mixed in, and every single one of my guys would drink the Performan Win water over the plain water and drink it pretty readily. So then I thought, well, gee, let's see about what happens if we put a muck bucket out in the field at night with the Performan Win mixed in and had 5 geldings standing out there and come back in the morning and the thing would be, like, virtually empty. Of course, I didn't know which ones were drinking it, but they were really keen on drinking it. So this weekend I was at the ride with Stag and Cheryl up in Virginia, and I put it in my horse's corrals, you know, from the time we got there until the time we left, and they did, you know, along with plain water, and they certainly drank it there. I didn't attempt to take it out on the trail. Well, I didn't have a crew, and all the vet checks were away, so I was doing well to show up with feed and hay and, you know, a horse. But, you know, in camp, all three of the horses of mine that were at the ride drank. So I you know, I kind of like that whole scenario, but I remember people saying, maybe John Crandall and those guys saying at that clinic that they could get their horses to drink it at home, but not necessarily at the rides. But I, somehow to me, the idea of putting it in water seems so much kinder or something to the stomach than, you know, taking that tube of light now and jamming it in their mouth. So
it's interesting. Your guys, at least, were certainly eating it at the ride site. You just don't know at the vet techs because they were.
Wilson didn't have it at the
vet techs. Oh, because you didn't have it.
Yeah, I didn't have it. But I
didn't know what vet check your riders were going
to
show up.
Exactly. And then there was my one horse that went off to some other vet check. And, you know,
right.
But, you know, he did. But they said he looked really good when he got there.
Yeah, he did.
And I guess, and he looked pretty good when he came back to the check he was supposed to be at. So.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, so I'm really kind of keyed up about this whole, you know, water, you know, electrolytes and water thing. If they just keep doing it, if it was me, I'd rather drink it that way than have somebody stuff it in. And you know, I've tasted just about every kind of paste electrolyte there is to taste because I always get it on my gloves and then it ends up in my mouth somehow. So.
Well, and that's the one study that has been done that shows, you know, those horses recover. Weight quicker, given it in an isotonic solution.
Yeah, yeah. So, I guess the key is though, will they actually keep? You know, will they actually do it at the rides and consistently? So,
how much per gallon are you putting in?
You know, not that much. And I'll. So you know, maybe I'm not giving them. You know, like, yeah, if they drink the whole bucket, they may be getting as much. So, you know, I'm not quite to the point where I'm not giving them a full 5 gallons when I put it in the bucket either. I maybe fill the bucket halfway, and then I throw three scoops or something in there. So it's really not, you know, I haven't been very scientific about it. I've been just sort of experimenting with will they drink it or will they not. And I kind of went back to this theory that I had an old horse I lost this summer, but she used to have a real problem with colicking in the winter when it was dry, and she wouldn't drink as much water. And I figured out at some point from riding around limited distance rides that she really liked orange Gatorade. She would just about fight me if I was drinking the Gatorade for some Gatorade. So I started taking scoops of orange Gatorade and throwing it in her in a water bucket in her stall in the winter, where she could, you know, she had access to come in and out of the stall at night, kind of thing. And she would come in there and drink the whole thing if I only put, you know, 2-3 scoops of Gatorade in 5 gallons, which, you know, you and I wouldn't drink because it would just taste like kind of yucky water. But something about the smell of it or something made her drink it. So I guess I've sort of taken that same attitude with, and then it really helped with the whole colic situation to get her to drink this, you know, Gatorade smelling water. So somehow, you know, I guess I've been sort of adding a little bit more, and I'm not even sure what would be, you know, how you'd figure out. I guess you'd have to figure out how much water you think the horse would actually drink at a vet check to figure out how much electrolytes you had to put in that water. You know what I'm saying? And I haven't gotten that far with it. I've sort of just been playing around with, you know, will they drink it at all? And I guess my answer on my horses so far has been yes.
Todd, how much, you know, if you were going to go the isotonic route, how would you figure out the amount of electrolytes to go with per, you know, per at the hold or whatever?
Well, so it, isotonic saline is 0.9%, so you just got to figure out, got to weigh your electrolytes and do the math. So 0.9% would be, let me show my math ignorance. I'm not a math guy. You're the math guy. 0.9% is
like one part in 100.
Wait a minute.
Very roughly.
It'll just, let me get a pencil and I'll figure it out for you. Go.
But you wouldn't have to go up to the isotonic limit, or though, right? Question.
Well, I think the, at least in my mind, the whole isotonic, the science behind trying to make it isotonic is that it's not tissue damaging. It's like I was, using the comparison of our contact solution. If you wear contacts, that's an isotonic salt solution. So it's the same salt solution that bathes your eye and your tears, and, you know.
Okay, so you're trying to match what's already.
You want to match what's in the body.
Body, right.
Mm. Tissue damaging, and then they can take the maximal amount of salt in with that water, and it shouldn't be offensive, you know, as offensive as hypertonic solutions as far as taste.
Right, and I guess
damaging the tissue, it shouldn't damage tissue at all.
And anything less than isotonic, in theory, then you'd be building up a debt over time because they're sweating out.
Like the lady was saying a minute ago, trying to figure out how much he was going to drink and how much he was going to lose, I guess I wouldn't go at it that way. I would do the math to figure out how many scoops I need to add in this 5-gallon bucket to make it a 0.9%, and then let him drink all he wants to drink.
Right, okay.
You know what I'm saying? That's how the study was done in the endurance exercise study that looked at that solution.
Okay, so this is going to sound ignorant, but okay, do I have to know the weight of a gallon of water then to know what?
No, I'm going to tell you in a minute.
I'm
going to do the math.
And actually, I sort of kind of am a math person, but my cold is affecting my brain, I think.
And as a theoretical mathematician, that means you say A, mean B, write C, and D is correct. So we'll let Todd figure out D.
There you go.
Lead you. Further questions on ulcers, or maybe we should switch to the more general, you know, what are things that Todd would recommend or that others on the phone use to minimize, in general, this transportation stress and getting to and from rides?
Just have one more quick question, if that's okay, and that's about potassium, because I brought this up with, I don't know about it with you, Stag, but with John Crandall, that I think it was Kathy Brunges who recommended to me in heat and humidity when I had an issue with my mare, potassium loading for a couple of days before the ride, and just kind of to hear what Todd thinks about that.
So can you hear me? Sorry, y'all are on a speakerphone, and my throat's not...
Hear you.
Okay, so potassium is a little different because it is a major... it is a major electrolyte loss in sweat, but it's also its major place that it lives in the body is inside of cells. Okay, so theoretically you could load potassium. Trying to think, really it really will depend on what the kidneys and the GI tract does with that potassium. There's so many physiological things that are involved. So let me back up and take it from a point of potassium loss. So if your horse goes through a 50 or 100 mile ride, and you know they lose sodium, chloride, potassium, calcium, magnesium, protein, and water in their sweat, at the end of the ride, if I take a blood sample and measure his sodium and chloride and potassium, he could have a normal potassium in the blood sample that I drew that came from his body, but his total body could be very, very low in potassium. So the theory that she is advocating comes from the point that we know that major potassium shifts occur when you lose potassium from your bloodstream or your plasma volume through the sweat. Potassium moves from inside the cell to outside the cell to replace it. So the theory of loading it is, you know, has a lot of scientific merit. Whether or not you truly increase total body potassium in that manner, or whether the kidneys just get rid of it, I'll have to dig in the literature and see if that's actually been proven.
But it's not harmful. It just may not be useful. Is that
correct? It is not harmful.
Okay. Because I have found anecdotally that...
Let me back up and say, let me clarify that, because we could be lawyers out there writing things down. You can kill a horse with oral potassium, okay? So when I say it's not harmful, as long as you're not giving an amount that is toxic, then it's not harmful. It'd be real hard to kill a horse with table salt, you know, that I'm dosing. In high enough doses, at high enough concentrations, you could theoretically kill a horse with straight potassium chloride.
Using that new salt stuff, that salt substitute, so I don't know if that's enough to be...
That's potassium chloride primarily, but, I mean, you'd have to give, again, have to do the math, but you'd have to give a pretty large volume.
Okay. It did seem to help her from getting muscle cramps.
And we know from human exercise, you know, people that have muscle cramps a lot, potassium supplementation is good for that, bananas and stuff.
And low potassium does cause what muscle cramps and pain,
yep.
Pain and muscles and all that, right?
You know, yep.
There's no way we had a horse that tended to really dip down on potassium, and if that was... You're saying if the potassium is low in the bloodstream, it's probably really low in the body then.
More than likely. But there are a lot of factors that can cause it to shift. And the big point was that at the end of the ride, you've most likely had major shifts, and you can measure a blood sample and think your potassium is fine, and your total body potassium could be really low. So I'm trying to do this simple math, and hang on a minute, 0.9%.
Okay. While he's doing that, people will be thinking about questions related to the more general question of reducing the stress as we take the horses from their home to a ride site. How we handle that, because more I was at a talk this last week, I guess, where Todd probably knows him, his real character, Dr. Pugh, formerly from
yeah,
and he's now an employee of Fort Dodge, but anyway, he was talking about how just even a short trailer ride reduces the
immune system
in a horse. And so we'll let Todd finish his calculation first. Would be interesting to, I don't think ARC's ever done a study like this to compare how horses' performance with trailer distance to the ride.
Yeah, there's a few actually that if you look at the data in the right way, you can come up with that the answer to your question. There's one study by Barton, University of Georgia, that looked at different distances at the Biltmore, I'm pretty sure is the ride. And some of those horses that were transported the furthest distance, I could pull the paper, but there was a difference in, I can't remember if it was performance parameters or some of the inflammatory things that she was measuring, but the greater distance, there was a difference in some of the data.
Okay, that showed
an effect on transport.
Yeah, a deleterious effect then.
Yeah. So the math is there's 9 grams of sodium chloride in 1,000 mils if it's a 0.9% solution, which is isotonic. So you have to figure out the weight of your salt solution, and then approximately 4 liters is a gallon, right?
Right, yeah.
So you would need 4 times 9, whatever that is.
36 less than
36.
Thanks. See, I told you I have to suck at this math stuff. So 36 grams per gallon. So 5 times that if you're going to fill your 5-gallon bucket up.
And that's of the actual electrolyte.
I'm sorry, say that again?
It would be sodium. It would be grams of sodium chloride. Some of these electrolyte powders and stuff, you got to make sure that you do the math right when you look at the ingredients, because it may have, each individual electrolyte may be listed in milligrams, whatever. Mm-hmm. The thing I do, this is going to sound really funny. So when I go places and I forget my contact solution, if you get used to what isotonic saline tastes like, you can probably mix your horse's electrolytes and taste them and go, wow, that tastes like a tear when I cry, or wow, that's really salty. Because I can do it pretty closely, making my own electrolytes for my contacts, and when I put them in my eye after I've tasted them and they taste right, it doesn't burn. Does that make sense?
Actually, yes. I was thinking that might be the easiest way to do it. You get it to the point where you taste it and it's okay, and then if you put more salt or whatever in it, it starts tasting salty, then you put more water in.
No.
As 0.9%.
Table salt?
I'm sorry, we're getting a lot of sound.
Hello?
Can y'all hear?
No, we're getting
now. It's back. Couldn't
I'm gonna hang.
Table salt.
Maybe me.
Oh, that was whoever it was.
Yeah.
Hello.
That static went away, right?
Yeah.
Oops. Did we get other people dropping off or not?
I'm still here.
Okay, I think it was
Deborah's
just
still here.
Cheryl, the aesthetic was on our home line. I'm on our business line.
Okay. Well, I mean, if you're really trying to get an isotonic solution, I would definitely do the math. But what I'm saying is once you do the math and make the solution, taste it yourself and get an idea what that is like.
Okay. Well, couldn't you just use table salt?
Yes.
It wouldn't taste so good, maybe.
No, it's going to have the same taste. Salt is salt, or sodium and chloride. Now, what it's not going to have in there that your horse still needs is calcium and potassium.
Okay.
You know? And magnesium. So, you know, I don't know if you're the lady that was talking about playing around with her horses at home drinking.
No, I'm not that lady.
I
will be now.
Well, the thing that I was going to advise her is that it may be that those horses have a preference to drink that Performin' Win because it has sugar in it.
And that did cross my mind, actually.
So if it has a really sweet taste, they may have different taste preferences for volume of intake. And the only study that I know is, you know, and internet is so valuable nowadays, there's nothing wrong with y'all pulling those papers I'm talking about and actually physically reading them and thinking about the science yourself. And if you have a question about it, you know, ask your veterinarian or email me or whatever. But, you know, some of that science is pretty convincing, and others of it, you know, you can pick it apart and say, well, wait a minute. You know, a lot of different factors can influence research projects and results.
Todd, if you could shoot me an email on the papers, and I'll just shoot that out to the whole group. And
okay.
That would be cool.
Yeah, I can get it out.
Or, yeah, even better, Cheryl will get that out. If you get the email to me, we'll get it to the group.
So, and Cheryl, if I don't do that, make sure you remind me.
Okay.
So if
track down your email address. That was a major accomplishment for
me. Yeah, okay, yeah, you got me. Ann forwarded it to me yesterday or the day before. So there's actually an article coming out in Endurance News on transport stress next month, I think, but September or whatever. But I'm happy to talk to y'all about, you know, my perception of how big a role that plays or things we can do to minimize it. I think the big one is if you're going long distance, like if you were going from Asheville to go do, you know, the Tevis or something, how frequently would y'all stop stag?
Well, our routine, everybody's different. Rojax or get them there as quickly as possible. Our routine is to do 10 to 12 hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
And then during the day, we try to stop every approximately 4 hours and get them off for about 15 minutes, ideally where they can graze on grass.
Yeah.
So we actually, you know, physically get them off the trailer.
Sure. And then that is, to me, the ideal transport plan, because getting them off every 4 hours, letting them drop their head, there are really good studies where where even just taking a horse and tying him to the stall, you know, or tying him to a post, whatever, head elevation confinement for as little as 6 hours, you can get bacteria down in their lower airways. So the fact that you take them off the trailer every 4 hours, especially to let them drop their head and graze, is a major important point, because that's what clears the airway of all the mucus containing the bacteria, you know, that otherwise would be stuck down in their lungs.
Yeah, and with high gas prices, if you do it at interstate stops in the pet area, you can get pony rides. And
there you go. That's a great idea. $5 a ride.
Right.
So other than that, during transport, because head confinement plays such a role, it's really nice if your trailer can allow, most of ours in America don't, but if you have a box type trailer situation where you don't have to tie their head, you know, and that's sometimes hard to allow them to drop their head during transport, but that's the best way to do it if you can.
Todd, you just raised the following question in my mind. I mean, if we have a single horse, we just turn them loose.
Mm-hmm. I think it's the best way.
We don't do that with multiple horses.
And that's kind of what I was thinking about as well. When we go down the road to go to shows, it would be impossible for me to take more than one horse and allow their head to drop.
Now, there are, of course, you know, many of the trailers today are slant load trailers, but, you know, Dwight Hooten convinced me that, you know, even in a slant load trailer, take out the dividers and let them go front to back, because, you know, actually letting them ride slanted tends to cause what he called slant load trailer lameness, because they're taking all the shock on one diagonal.
Mm-hmm.
What's your feeling on which slant load versus straight load?
I would tend to agree with him. I think there are some studies that actually have looked at that, and I'm pretty sure the horses that are allowed to go loose prefer to turn around backwards. but I haven't really seen any studies that have compared slant load, you know, in any kind of lateralizing stress things that you could measure, you know, whether you took horses and trailered them for 24 hours and took muscle biopsies before and after in the hind limbs and looked at the glycogen depletion in one hind limb versus the other, depending on direction. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I don't know that study's been done. I'm not aware of it, if it has. But I can imagine that slant loading, I mean, I've seen, you know, personal experience with different horses trailered that you know, come out of a slant load, you know, stiff in one hind limb or the other, but I don't know of any science behind it. But it makes, you know, as a horseman and a veterinarian, makes sense that the stress is not equal. So I guess I would prefer, number one preference would be open type trailer with one horse, or if you have a stock type trailer and you have two horses, and you don't have to worry about putting anything else in your trailer if it has a divider, then put one in the front and one in the back. You know, but once you get more than a couple of horses, that's hard to do in a typical trailer. Big thing is head carriage, if at least you could let them drop their head. If not, stop like y'all are doing every 4 hours. And then water. There have been some studies that have shown, you know, even horses offered water don't drink as much as they would if they weren't transported.
At least from a... This is, again, non-scientific, but empirical. Our guys, once you put them on a trailer and you offer them water, they kind of look at you with this jaundiced look. You want me to do what?
Sure.
Yeah.
And there's some good science that backs that up, that they just don't drink the same amount.
And a slant load, they're never going to get their head all the way down, even if you don't tie them, just because of the mangers, right?
Sure. Yep. Yep. Unless you got a really short horse front to back.
Or don't have mangers.
Or no mangers.
You know, there are some, like our trailer doesn't have mangers, and it's got a little hay, like a hay bag that's halfway, about at the horse's chest height. But I still don't think that's the same as letting them eat off the ground.
And then how long are they off the trailer for? I mean, you take a whole hour or just...
No, I don't think you need to do that. I mean, to me, even if all I did was get my horses off long enough to let them take 5 bites of grass while everybody in the truck went to pee at the rest stop, you know, and you got back in and ran, I think that's better than not letting them off. The mucociliary transport apparatus pretty rapidly... you know, runs towards the pharynx when they drop their head.
Yeah, our routine is if we stop at an interstate rest stop, it's usually 10 to 15 minutes while everybody goes and pees and they get a chance to eat a little. So I'd say on average 10 to 15. If we stop for gas, it's probably more like 20 minutes, but there our routine, we're sort of developing a list of gas stations that have nice grass. Like there's a Love's at exit 84 on I-81. That's one of our favorites. And there our routine is we go pull the horses over. We unload them next to wherever the grassy area is, and one person grazes the horse while the other person goes and fills up the truck with gasoline, and then once the truck is full, you swap off, and the other person goes and pees and all that, so that by the time you're finished there, it's usually 20, 25 minutes. But that's been a fairly good routine for us.
It also helps keep, while the horses will poop in the trailer, they tend to pee at the stops, which is nice from an interior trailer ambiance.
Most of ours have gotten, they may not drink, but boy, as soon as you get them off the trailer, they're usually peeing within a few minutes. We have geldings, but
some of them are more shy than others, but they get the idea. Is there any other what you might call good tricks?
Well, one thing.
Ours. Go ahead, Stag.
Yeah, I was just going to say one thing that we do that I'll just share with folks that goes back to a bad experience we had many years ago. We always put a fly mask over our horses, you know, heads, one that covers their eye totally, because we came back, I guess it was 92 from the national championships with our horses, and Drubin developed a conjunctivitis after that, and the vet came out, treated it, and it went away, came back, and God, it was 2 or 3 months later, probably 3 months later, the vet noticed a pussy area right on the eyelid that wasn't clearing up. Well, it turned out that was the tip of an oat seed that had got embedded in his eyelid from that trailering. It had been there the whole time, which was why the conjunctivitis kept coming back. And we had, you know, we had trailered out there with oat hay because that's what we got in California. And so we just got very paranoid about, you know, all the stuff that blows in a trailer from the hay net and everything else. And so we've always used a fly mask whenever they go in a trailer.
Yeah, I think that's a really great, great point. I, you know, a lot of these horse trailers nowadays have the fold-down windows, and some of them have great grates that'll open all the way up to have your horse where he can stick his head all the way out the trailer, and I just think that's an accident waiting to happen.
In terms of air, though, would you say the more air, the better, provided, you know,
to keep
the horse from getting his head in trouble?
Yeah.
Well, and on that note, I guess I'm going to throw in my 2 cents worth. This is Allison again. Back at that Apex clinic again in Athens, Diana Rojek did that piece on thermoregulation and was talking about the importance of, you know, airflow in the trailer. And she made some brief reference to a horse she had that had horizontal hoof cracks that they had determined they felt like they were related to the heat coming up through the floor in the trailer. And we had both Mike and my horses, when we were both riding together, coming up with these horizontal cracks and had all sorts of vets and farrier and everybody else trying to fathom out the cause for it, and everybody tending to point their finger at just, well, it's stress from the rides. Well, okay, yeah, my farrier could look at it and say, okay, this one was this ride and this one was this ride. But my argument was still going back to, yeah, but why would my horses have them then? Why would you not see them on every horse at this endurance ride that did the same ride? Or, you know, unless it was dietary or something. But anyway, Dinah said she made some reference to the heat in the trailer, and I asked her afterwards, and she said, so add some extra mats and bed up with, you know, she talked about bedding with bedding, and this year I did that. Last year, Kazar had gotten 2 horizontal cracks, and they line up directly with his trip to the Old Dominion in June, where, yeah, he did 100, but it was not, you know, what was it, like 100 degrees on the Friday, I think, when we got there or something. And then the second crack was the Big South Fork last September. And again, in both trips, you know, more than 7 hours of driving and way over 90 degrees outside. So this year I've added extra mats, and I'm throwing sawdust in there, and the fly masks, by the way, to keep the sawdust from flying into the eyes. But I went back to Big South Fork, is I guess the furthest one I've done so far this season, and it was very, very hot in June, end of June, and so far so good, no cracks. So, you know, I'm beginning to think maybe there was something to Dinah's comment about the heat coming up through the floor of the trailer. And I think our cracks, too, didn't start until we bought this trailer we have now, and it has sprayed-in floor mats, not traditional rubber mats. So now I have traditional rubber mats on top of the sprayed-in mats, and I'm bedding on top of that.
That's fascinating. I wish I could remember. I know Super after the Tevis, we really needed to give them a long time off because of, you know, hoof structure changes and all.
Yeah.
And he trailered out through really nasty heat.
Yeah, 100-plus degree stuff.
Yeah, nasty heat, and I never made the correlation. That's.
Well, she said something like, have you ever gone and, what maybe you guys were talking about unloading horses too at rest areas and stuff, and she said something like, you know, have you ever tried to stand in the back of your horse trailer, you know, in June or July or August in the southeast? You know, how hot is that heat coming up through your shoes? So anyway, I just thought I'd throw that out because that's my trailering change of the year is adding these extra mats. And yeah, it's more work for me to clean out when I have to drag those mats out and clean under them and all that. But hey, beats the daylights out of some cracks in his hooves.
Yeah,
and like I said, so far so good. You know, knock on wood, that he, you know, is crack free.
Yeah, that's a great point. Particularly with the Big South Fork coming up, and that could be a hot weekend.
It usually is.
Todd, what's your recommendation in terms of time to arrive to give a horse to recover before competition?
Like long distance.
Yeah, like, you know, X amount of recovery time for Y amount of trailer time, or any, you know, good rules of thumb there.
Well, you know, just thinking here, you know, it would be really nice if you could give him a day of rest for every 12 hours of transport, but I don't know if that's feasible. You know, and then the part of it is also, you know, that we deal with, especially with international, is the acclimation, you know, what that horse is trained in versus what they're going to compete in. You know, so if you're just talking local transport, you know, within the states, as far as road transport, you know, it'd be really nice if for every 12 hours of transport, he had a day of rest. But that's just a gut feeling kind of thing. I don't know of any science behind looking at it in that kind of ratio recommendation. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Okay.
I do know that from the longer distance transport studies where they don't take them off, you know, like stress transport, there's a lot of, well, prior to when we used to have horse slaughter in the United States, they're you know, in the last, I don't know, 20 years maybe, there's research looking primarily from animal science departments looking at the effect of transport long distance without access to water, you know, simulating horses that are transported long distance to slaughter. And it takes those horses, you know, that 24-hour road models, it takes them, I think, I have to pull the papers, but I still think from reading those memory-wise that some of those horses weren't rehydrated fully within 24 hours.
Okay.
You know, based on weight, which is somewhat, you know, they can lose weight beyond water weight as well. I mean, what do you try to do, like, if you were going to the Tevis, had they not been smoked out? You know, what would you,
Tevis, you know, where they're really across the country in a total change, yeah, we got there basically, our horses got there a week ahead of time, right, Cheryl? Jeannie actually trailered our horse out.
Yeah, I'm trying to say it was a bit over a week. It was less than 2 weeks, and I think a couple of days over a week,
yeah.
Like 9 days.
Yeah, 8 or 9 days. John actually thought for Tevis, with such a radical change and such a long trailer ride, that wasn't long enough. He thought, you know, if you're going to ship a horse from the East Coast out to Tevis, he likes to get him out there a couple of weeks ahead of time.
And I don't know how much of that is truly acclimation, because it takes, you know, or the desire to have them acclimated to the climate change and the elevation change, because it takes, You know, so when you try to start separating how much of it's transport and how much of it is an environmental change, it takes a lot longer. From what reading I understand from the science, it takes a lot longer to acclimate and adapt to a difference in humidity, heat, and elevation than it does to physically recover from the stress of the ride. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But it's equally, if not more important.
Yeah.
I think the horses that we took to Malaysia last year could have benefited from at least another week.
Yeah, and I felt super.
That's probably why I haven't thought of it in the terms of how many hours on the road versus how many days of rest, because I don't think it's that simple. Really.
Your rule of thumb, actually, I think, particularly if you're staying in the same part of the country, sounds like a good one to me. You know, like if I were going from here to Vermont, you know, it's a day and a half trip to ride, and I'd want to get there it's a day and a half in the sense it's 18 hours.
Mm-hmm.
I'd want to get there a day and a half, i.e. 36 hours ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm going to do Old Dominion or Big South Fork or something like this, which is a day's trailer ride, I want a full day to recover.
Mm-hmm. I think that really, really changes, though, when you go from, you know, when you factor in elevation or you factor in heat and humidity into it, you know.
Yeah. You know, I think that's part of what makes it so tough when Western horses come out here or vice versa. It is a totally different environment.
So most of the riders that are in Apex Group, are they almost all on the East Coast or not?
Well, Rick is in Illinois, who's on the phone tonight. Deborah's New York. Allison is North Carolina.
Oh, okay.
Most of Apex is east of the Mississippi, although not all.
Mm-hmm.
I at least have one.
Anna Wolf is our serious outlier, and Jessica DiCamillo is a recent addenda outlier, both, I think, in New Mexico, as it turns out.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And we've actually got requests to take our Apex clinics out to both the Oregon area and up to Canada, and also Western Canada. We've already been up to Eastern Canada, so
mm-hmm.
hopefully we'll be, you know, extending.
Yeah, that's good.
I think we ought to ask for last questions/points and wrap. What do you think?
Yeah, I think you can go around and do, you know, and Todd's a great resource, and always one of my favorite vets to be at a ride or to be a team vet or whatever. So, well, we've got him on the phone. Any additional questions from folks?
No, I think it's been really helpful, though.
Yeah, me too.
I think the interactive, I've never done this before with a group of competitors. I think the interactive comments from the riders is just incredibly interesting. You know, the lady that was talking about the heat from the bottom of the trailer, I think that is just too cool. There's just so much from people's experience with horses that, you know, that we can all learn from.
Yeah, and that's part of what, you know, Apex is all about, is to try to capture all this and transfer the knowledge. And
because
every time we put on a clinic, I learn from everybody who comes.
Well, me as well. I don't think I own a fly mask. I'm pretty sure I'm going to go get it from a wife.
Before people leave, one idea for next topic, I just wanted to get a reaction from those on the phone, would be to have Dwayne Barnett talk about drug testing and drug rules. He's president of the ARC, not president, chair of the ARC Drug Testing Committee or whatever official title is, and you know, drug clearance times and all of that. Is that something that people think would be of interest on a call?
Yeah,
definitely. Then I quit bugging him personally. You
okay.
know, one question here and one question there.
I talked to him about.
He doesn't even want to ride with me anymore. No.
Cece coming and goes in the other direction. Yeah. Okay.
No.
Okay, good. Well, we'll work on that for the next call, which should be in, what, 2 months, Cheryl?
2 months, yeah.
And you know, obviously send in questions and ideas.
Will that be after the championship then?
We could try doing it actually before the national championship.
Yeah, why don't we maybe do it a week before or something?
Yeah, enough time so that people can actually...
Just leave us enough time...
...drugs that you've got in your horse's system.
No, leave us enough time to travel up there and get the right travel rest time.
That's right, yes.
I'm trying to sort that one out right now, so I'm glad somebody asked that or you guys brought that up because I'm like, okay, when am I leaving?
Yep.
Anyway.
Yep.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay, and Todd, thank you so much.
Yep. Well, I enjoyed it. I'm
excited, Todd.
It's good to talk to you all. Good to hear voices from people that I miss.
Okay. Well, look forward to getting you back here again.
All right. Thanks.
Okay.
Thanks. Have a good evening,
folks.
Bye. Bye.